from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. One of today's guests says the problem with this statement is that more than 40% of adult Americans believe these words from Karl Marx were part of America's founding documents. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we speak with the author of Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate. On tap for discussion today is the decline of civic knowledge and the nature of First Amendment rights on our nation's college and university campuses. Plus, we hear from UMKC and Rockhurst students who plan to weigh in on campus censorship. That's on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. City. Abraham Lincoln once said of education and government that the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of the government in the next. Our discussion today will address the issue of whether censorship policies on college campuses are setting the tone not only for our government, but for our national conversation, where free speech is often pitted against political correctness and the administrative agendas of our nation's colleges and universities. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. And joining us now from NPR Studios in New York is First Amendment lawyer Greg Lukianoff, the author of the book called Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate. Plus, later in the hour, we'll hear from two students, one from Rockhurst College and one from UMKC, about their ability or inability to speak out on their respective campuses. For now, Greg Lukianoff, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
What drew you to free speech law, free speech lawyering?
Well, I talk about it in the book, and I think it's my second earliest memory is that my father's a Russian immigrant and my mother's a British immigrant, and Russians and Brits have very different ideas about what's appropriate to say. My dad was always encouraging me to be direct and honest to the point of rudeness, and my mother was always emphasizing that I be polite. And so from a very early age, it became very clear that it made sense for the government not to be allowed to say to make those decisions for you. That essentially, if you put my mom in charge, one set of kind of speech would be banned. If you put my dad in charge, another would be. If my next door neighbors, who were also immigrants, had different ideas. So to me, it came actually from growing up in a genuinely diverse pluralist society that I actually saw, wow, what a great innovation. Everybody gets to have their own opinion. They don't necessarily mean it doesn't mean they're all true, but that the government can actually choose a side and say this is what the opinion you have to have. So after that, I went to I grew up with this lifelong belief in free speech, and then I went to undergraduate where I studied journalism. And all journalists get free speech better than almost anybody else in the society because they understand that no matter how well-intentioned, and almost all movements in censorship history are by somebody well-intentioned, will come back to haunt journalists first. And that's a generalized threat to our ability to disseminate information as part of our democracy. I then specialized in First Amendment law at Stanford, took every class they had, and even did 6 additional credits on censorship during the Tudor dynasty, because that has some effect on American legal history. So this has been a lifelong passion of mine.
And later became a Showtime extravaganza as well, the Tudor dynasty, starring Jonathan Rhys Meyers.
I finally watched that last fall.
Tell us about the organization that you're also president of, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. Tell us about that.
Happy to. It was founded in 1999 by Alan Charles Kors, who's a more conservative-leaning libertarian and scholar of the Enlightenment, and Harvey Silverglate, who's an old-school ACLU civil liberties attorney up in Boston. And they got together to form FIRE because they saw students, unlike in the 70s, students in the 80s were increasingly getting in trouble for what they said, not for what they did. And for the real believers in the free speech movement of the 60s and 70s, they thought something really had gone wrong. So they wrote a book in 1998 called The Shadow University, which was just a listing and showing all the different ways in which due process was being ignored, free speech was being ignored. After writing that, rather than solving the problem, what ended up happening was they got so many requests for help that they realized they have to form a nonprofit, FIRE, in 1999, and I joined it as its first legal director back in 2001.
And it became so pervasive, censorship and suppression at these campuses, that you write this follow-up book, Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate, which is a collection of cases you've worked on and cases you've observed that run from the ridiculous to the surreal and back, and have created what you call an unscholarly certainty about complex issues. Talk about that, an unscholarly certainty about complex issues.
Right. There's so many good reasons to believe in freedom of speech, and it's one of these things where I think people aren't being taught sufficiently how profound an innovation the idea of freedom of speech, academic freedom, free inquiry actually is. And among the multitude of arguments for freedom of speech, some of the best were made in 1859 by John Stuart Mill, but they get increasingly reproven all the time. And that is, if you're that lucky person or non-existent person who happens to be 100% right about 100% of things, even you benefit from freedom of speech. Because if you just, you know, have beliefs that are correct, but you never have them challenged, you end up holding your beliefs the same way people hold prejudices. They know what they stand for. They're at a complete loss to explain why they have those beliefs. And what happens when you introduce even the slightest risk of punishment for someone giving a wrong opinion, engaging in the wrong devil's advocacy, engaging in the wrong thought experiment, it's not like people really change their minds. They end up doing what I think our entire society is doing to its own detriment, is they tend to just keep their mouth shut around people they disagree with and talk to people they already agree with, which social science has been very good at showing fosters group polarization. It leads people to be very certain that they're right, but without a really good knowledge of what the other arguments actually are. And Cass Sunstein has actually done a lot of work on this, about how increasingly polarized we are. And it's partially because we live in communities where increasingly politically homogenous. We've literally moved to different neighborhoods within the country. We also have the ability to sort of cyber sequester ourselves into just the streams of information that we agree with. And my argument in Unlearning Liberty is that the only mass mechanism we have for teaching people better intellectual habits, teaching them that wonderful intellectual duty to seek out the intelligent person you disagree with, that's higher education. And it's so far from that if you can actually get in trouble just for speaking your mind.
And you've also cited a decline in your book on the emphasis on civics or social studies as contributing to people's knowledge of their rights. Talk about that. And you say it begins in high school.
Yeah, one of the things that's happened in the whole course of the emphasis on STEM, of course, I'm a big believer in science and math, and I want people to know more about that. Civics, however, is not getting taught at this at least a nearly adequate level. So concepts like due process and freedom of speech, and for that matter, the way our government is actually structured, are not sufficiently understood by the time people head off to college, and sometimes aren't even explained when they are in college. Now, I think that in the book, I start the reader off in high school, because one thing that I've definitely seen over the years is the need for organizations like the Student Press Law Center that defend the right of the student press in high schools, because it's really easy, and a lot of times it's just for being critical of the administration, for getting in trouble for writing for your student newspaper these days in high schools. Now, the rights of K-12 are different. We understand K-12 to have somewhat diminished rights on a variety of levels due to the fact that they're below 18, but also due to the fact that we don't rely on higher education to be our intellectual engine of innovation and change, creativity and dynamism. We do rely on higher education to be that. And in my opinion, as I said, it can't work if people can actually get in trouble for their opinions. And I go even farther than that. We as a society rely on American higher education to be uniquely innovative. The entire world does. Higher education is still considered to be one of our great assets. But I think that one thing that can really sort of erode it or corrupt it from within is if people have to think twice about engaging in thought experiments and engaging in devil's advocacy, or for that matter, satire or parody. I explain it in many cases. You know, sometimes through satire and parody, you actually end up having a community talk about things that is really bothering it, but they can only deal with it through jokes.
There are so many cases in this book, from students being censored and professors being censured. How did it get this way in 2012? Greg Lukianoff?
You know, people always ask me that, and I try to just present the information as best I can, and my surreal experience is partially out of frustration of doing this for 11 years and having people be like, well, what's the big deal? We all know that, you know, sometimes administrators can be a little heavy-handed. But I do point to four different causes, I think, of why you end up having these, you know, why you would end up having, like this summer, an administrator at University of Cincinnati and an entire administration willing to go to court to defend the right of the administration to limit free speech to only 0.1% of campus and to demand 10 days advance notice for students just to hand out a ballot initiative. Now, you don't have to be a First Amendment expert to know that that's wildly unconstitutional.
So quarantining free speech to a specific area or ghettoizing free speech on the college
campus. And a tiny area at that. Nobody would ever consider that to be, you know, a reasonable limitation on freedom of speech. And how you get to the point where this is happening, and I think there's four primary factors. One of them is probably the least understood is fear of liability. There's definitely there's a risk management industry out there, and the conventional wisdom has been, you know, you might get sued for harassment, you might get sued for discrimination. Why don't you just pass really restrictive speech codes so you can, if you do get sued for that, you can show that you did something. Now, this is a terrible idea because harassment has a strict legal definition. If you have that, you're protected. And the idea that you actually would expand the definition so broadly that would make you any more protected is just nonsense. But it is something that unfortunately administrators seem to think is a good idea.
And that feeds into one of your other factors, bureaucracy.
Exactly. There's been a huge expansion of campus bureaucracy. And this is something that I get pushback, of course, from campus administrators. But it's, you know, it's the government's own reports. Between 2005 and 2006, the number of people involved in staffing administration at universities finally passed the number of people involved in instruction. And I think that the American public needs to know about this because prices have been going absolutely haywire. But a big part of that cost is actually not going to professors and to instructors. It's going to the expansion of this ever-expanding bureaucracy. The third thing that I point to, which you've already touched on a little bit, is that people don't know that free speech is this brilliant innovation and that academic freedom is essential to the integrity of higher education. And I think these mid-level administrators don't get a good proper education in that.
You call it ignorance.
Yeah, I do. It's a strong word, but I think it's accurate. That simply they're just not being taught how powerful these ideas are. But the final one, which I make no bones about, is there is still a politically correct idea that that it's good that people never be offended on campus. And I think that's while it comes from a well-intentioned place, it ends up manifesting exactly like any First Amendment lawyer would tell you it does, which is sometimes, sure, people work with good intentions. For the most part, people's intentions are fairly mixed. And in other cases, you have people using these speech codes as justifications just to punish students who disagree with the administration or who are critical of the administration. And that's about as predictable as anything could be in the history of free speech.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our First Amendment lawyer guest is Greg Lukianoff, the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. He joins us from NPR Studios in New York, and he's the author of the book called Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship and the End of American Debate. Later in the hour, we'll hear from two students, one from Rockhurst and one from UMKC, about their ability or inability or experiences in speaking out on their respective college campuses. But right now, Greg Lukianoff, in your book, you argue that free speech on campus is not a liberal or conservative issue per se, but an issue that puts critical thinking in peril. Expound on that, if you will.
Absolutely. And it goes back to the theme that runs through the entire book of certainty, that and I made a point of not having the word epistemology in the book, but ultimately that's a major reason why people actually believe in freedom of speech. That essentially freedom of speech is an admission that I'm not omniscient. I don't know everything, and probably you aren't either. And this is a great societal innovation to finally accept this and say, you know what, wisdom can come from funny places, good ideas can come from discussions that came out of bad ideas, that this free-willing sort of process of open inquiry can't really work if you put a straitjacket on it. And so one of the things I try to emphasize in the book is when it comes to sort of like the conservative liberal idea is that, yes, it's true that socially conservative ideas tend to be more controversial on campus. That being said, I open up talking about one of the worst cases I've ever seen, which is an environmentalist student getting kicked out of school for protesting a parking garage.
This was the collage that he made about the parking garage there.
Yes. It's an incredible case. Environmentalist student, Shambhala Buddhist, believer in nonviolence, decorated EMT, critical of the administration for starting a parking garage, that I thought there was more environmentally friendly ways to handle the parking issue on campus. And he gets hauled into the president's office. He gets dressed down for it for like over an hour. And then this is just for writing an op-ed and for contacting the Board of Regents in a very responsible, respectful way on a serious issue. So after being dressed down by the president, he makes a collage, which we're going to have some pictures of this on the Huffington Post on Monday. I've been blogging there since 2007. And the collage is it's the SAVE, SAVE, which is the environmentalist group at Valdosta State University that Hayden Barnes, the students involved, thought had fallen down to the job, and Zachariah Memorial Parking Garage, and then it had a picture of a crushed earth and no blood for oil and an asthma inhaler. And the point being that this is the president had sort of referred to this parking garage as part of his legacy, and this was sort of a joke on this is going to be your legacy, both environmentalist group and President Zachariah.
But the nomenclature of memorial ended up getting him in trouble and ended up being the cause for that. Pretty silly, but
it ended up being. It ended up being the excuse for that,
right? Because the excuse.
When you end up looking at the at the discovery and the legal decisions that have come out from it, it's clear that the president wanted to find an excuse to kick this student out or to punish this student, and the collage was what he hung his hat on. And the argument was that memorials usually happen after you're dead, so
and that's
therefore
a threat.
This was a threat on the president of the university's life. And if anybody and sometimes people they really want to think the best, and maybe he really was scared. The thing that really gives proof to the fact. Just in normal everyday action, besides reading the opinions on how long this had gone on, was the fact that the president had stapled this collage to the student's eviction notice and slid it under his door. If you actually think someone's going to be the next Cho, if you think actually someone's going to be the next violent, aggressor on campus, you don't slip a note under their door saying, get off campus right now. It was clear that they were never afraid of him in the first place. So even after he got a psychologist and a psychiatrist to say, this guy is a threat to absolutely nobody, they still wouldn't let him back in school. So back to the point about liberal and conservative. An awful lot of our cases, in another sense, are really apolitical. There's a lot of cases in which people are just being critical of, parking at certain schools or other departments that they think don't run very well and getting the book thrown at them. And in the cases where I talk about students going after student newspapers and destroying them, newspaper theft, where a group of students will get together and destroy entire press runs of student newspapers because they print articles that people don't like, those are some of the most not apolitical, self-interested. A lot of times they'll go after it because something's critical of a fraternity. That happens way too often, that fraternities will go out and destroy entire press runs of newspapers. In other cases, it's someone's being critical of the student government. The student government officials will go out and throw out student newspapers. Probably the most self-serving and creepiest one of all, though, and like, most classic one, of course, it was at Berkeley, where the mayor of Berkeley
Actual mayor of Berkeley.
Exactly. Was actually caught red-handed throwing out bales of the student newspaper that had endorsed his opponent.
For UC Berkeley.
Yep.
A grown man.
Yeah, a grown man.
throwing out the student newspaper.
The mayor of Berkeley threw out the student newspaper for endorsing his opponent. Amazing.
Let's talk about one of the extreme cases where the actual student body wanted to be involved in censorship. Talk about this case of a proposed sedition act at the University of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The student government proposed that. That's crazy.
And that's the thing. It's kind of like I've been doing this for 11 years, and I'd like to think it doesn't surprise me, but every so often I'm like, are you kidding me? So student governments, and I have a whole chapter, a chunk of a chapter talking about student governments acting like banana republics and how this should keep people up at night because some of the tactics that they use.
You mean the kind that sell khakis or the Latin American
petty dictatorships.
Okay, petty dictatorships. Okay, there we go.
Right, exactly. And in this case, universities at University of Milwaukee, University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, the student government, without any sense of irony whatsoever, passed a rule against quote-unquote sedition, explaining that if you're critical of the student government, that they will seek basically lawsuit and punishment against you. And they called it the Sedition Act without seemingly completely oblivious of the fact that the that John Adams' 1798 Alien Sedition Act is considered, one, to be a shameful chapter in American history, and two, to pretty much define unconstitutionality under our understanding of the First Amendment today. But they passed it nonetheless. It took a combination of exposure from us, I think also the ACLU, and from just general public scorn for them to veto the Sedition Act. But the idea that they even thought a Sedition Act at a public university was a good idea in the first place is insanity.
We'll be hearing in a few minutes from students at a public and private university, respectively. So tell us, Greg Lukianoff, what did you find to be the differences between public and private universities in terms of the ability or inability to speak freely on the part of the students and or faculty?
Well, first of all, the rights are different. At a public university, flatly, the First Amendment binds what you do. That binds what the administration is allowed to censor, and the First Amendment is interpreted to provide very strong free speech rights to students and faculty, for that matter, but particularly to students. Since at least the 1970s, it's been very strongly interpreted to protect student rights. Private universities are a little different, in that they're not bound directly by the First Amendment. In California, they're bound by something called the Leonard Law that applies First Amendment standards. But at most other colleges, at private colleges, really what you're bound by are your promises, whether or not you promise free speech and academic freedom. But here's the thing. It's hard for a good liberal arts college to get the best students, to get the best faculty, and to get the best donations, for that matter, if they don't promise basic academic freedom and free speech, because, you know, the rest of the society still totally understands that a university really can't function very well without it. And besides, who wants to be hired by a university that could kick you out at any time for your opinion? So the overwhelming majority of private colleges, particularly the elites, the Harvards, the Yales, the Syracuses, the Stanfords, promise free speech in glowing language, and our position, and it's backed up by some case law, is that universities should be held to those promises of freedom of speech. Now, whether or not you're more likely to get in trouble at a private university or public university, it's really been funny. It's really been a funny mixed bag. Even though private universities are bound by the First Amendment, public universities are bound by the First Amendment. Sometimes they act worse than private universities, which is really bizarre, given that the public universities are, if they get caught, they're going to get sued and lose. Whereas private universities, it might just be a public embarrassment.
Talk about sort of this far-reaching ethos among private and public colleges that's sort of like the speed limit in Montana, where their defense is sometimes, okay, we'll defend what's reasonable and prudent. Do you get that beyond a reasonable sort of situation? We defend First Amendment rights, but only to a reasonable standpoint.
I think that I haven't really seen that to be the case, though, I guess is one of the things I talk about consistently in the book is that it's and I point to some of the absurdity of a lot of these cases, that they may be they're oftentimes arguing against speech that might be, truly heinous or truly hateful. But then what ends up happening is you have cases like the one I talk about and I've talked about a lot in Indiana, where a student was literally found guilty of racial harassment because he was reading a book called Notre Dame versus the Klan. It's about the defeat of the Klan in 1924 when they marched on Notre Dame. It celebrates the defeat of the Klan in 1924, but because it has a picture related to the rally on the cover, and it made some students uncomfortable, he was found guilty of racial harassment without a chance to even defend himself. So if they were making the argument that they're just trying to be reasonable, they're not doing a very good job of it.
How has the culture of political correctness and outrage, both contrived and justified, hurt the free speech movement on campus?
political correctness, it's one of those things. I use the term in the book, but it's always a term that I'm not a huge fan of it, partially because it means such different things to different people. To conservatives, it means one thing. To liberals, it means another. But feigned outrage is something I talk a lot about in the book. And I talk about the what happened with Rush Limbaugh, Bill Maher, and Robert De Niro. And I show how we've learned as a society to accept feigned outrage. And this goes back to, Rush Limbaugh, back when Sandra Fluke testified before the Senate. Rush Limbaugh famously and horribly called her a slut, for which Rush Limbaugh later apologized. But our culture war being the culture war, people very quickly pointed out that Bill Maher had said some really horrible things about Sarah Palin over the years. So, ha-ha, another bit of culture war upmanship. But it reached a sort of like absurd high point when someone actually it was Newt Gingrich demanded an apology because Robert De Niro had made a joke that included a reference to Calista Gingrich that said that said, "Are we really ready for white first lady?"
Right.
I mean, it's a joke that counts, that's cute, if anything. Like, the idea that anybody could actually be offended by that is just, it's implausible. So Bill Maher wrote this great piece about how addicted our society has gotten to feigned outrage, that we... it's almost like it gives us sort of like purpose and a way to sort of really go after our enemies, and that we really taught ourselves to sort of overreact at some level to things that offend us because it gives us one over on our enemies.
Yeah, he said stop apologizing.
Yeah. And I point out that, that universities have to stop teaching the value of feigned outrage.
Our guest is First Amendment lawyer Greg Lukianoff, the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. He's the author of a book called Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we continue our discussion with two students, one from UMKC, one from Rockhurst, about their ability and inability to speak out on their respective campuses. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. If you're a student thinking of posting something about a professor or administrator on Facebook, or if you're a professor or administrator who wants to make an ironic point or stoke the fire of debate, if you want to write a poem, paint a painting, draw a cartoon, just be aware that there may be grave consequences on your local and college and university campuses. We've been talking with First Amendment lawyer Greg Lukianoff, the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. He joins us from NPR studios in New York. He's the author of a book called Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate. And we're also joined now in the studio by a political science and communications major at Rockhurst, Quentin Savoir, and Rose Brooks, a senior majoring in journalism and creative writing here at UMKC. But before we hear from them, Greg, what are your thoughts on the experiences of students? You paint a picture of a hypothetical student starting in high school, mm-hmm. and going to college and sort of being disenchanted by some of the First Amendment stifling that they encounter.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And one of the things that I try to talk about is how subtle I think the harm actually can be. Because if students learn to, keep their mouth shut sometimes when they disagree with their professor, to talk to people they already agree with, to sort of learn those bad habits of putting yourself in sort of an echo chamber, then they can make it through higher education thinking everything's fine and dandy. Everything's totally great. Never run into trouble with the administration. Never get in trouble. If you don't bother to protest, you're not going to run into trouble with speech zones. So I think for the overwhelming majority of students, this probably won't necessarily ring true as an issue, partially because people have internalized so much of the rules that keep you that prevent good and constructive discourse from happening.
And let's begin with Rose. Rose, do you feel there are too many restrictions on free speech on the UMKC campus? You were nodding your head when Greg Lukianoff mentioned the theft of student newspapers that's sort of rampant across the country when a story comes out that a student or an administrator or the mayor of Berkeley doesn't like. Talk about what's happening on UMKC's campus.
Correct. We've definitely had instances of papers disappearing or backlash from a article that's been written in the paper, but it's typically from the students. We've never had a lot of backlash from administration or the powers that be telling us what we can or cannot write. It's been students coming to administration saying, "I don't like this," but there's really not there's really no fault in the paper.
But what about the sort of path to expression? You got to go through a big time bureaucracy at UMKC to get a permit to protest or be somewhere or book a hall. Talk about that.
Correct. Yeah, there is a process. Organizations are really the only ones that are allowed to use spaces inside this, our new student union. There's a form that you have to fill out to use demonstration spaces, and it's a 10-day notice, and you have to fill it out, and they have to look at it. I'm not sure if they have to approve or deny, but you have to give them notice. And then there's discrepancy on the spaces that we can use, is what we've found recently. At the end of October, we had an instance where someone was using a space that the rest of us were under the impression wasn't an option. So that it was confusion more than anything.
So you do find that the free speech rules, sort of on one hand permissive and on the other hand restrictive, you find them to be confusing. Do you think they should be clarified?
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. There's language in our campus rules and regulations that are very vague. They don't talk about counter protests. They don't talk about, you know, consequences if you do X, Y, or Z during a regular protest, or what even a protest is defined as. So it is very confusing.
You said you've had friends that have encountered some pushback from the university or administration or from some of these ambiguous rules. Talk about some of those.
Yeah, we have a Chick-fil-A on campus, okay?
And that
definitely prompted some backlash from students who were very adamant about that no longer being on our campus. And when finding out what options we had or they had to protest or demonstrate at the student union where that Chick-fil-A is located, they were told they had to do a number of things. And then to find later that those things didn't apply to everybody, or that at least the message that is being sent from the powers that be that are above our administration. So it's a lack of communication between the uppers, even higher than our UMKC administration, our administration there, and then relaying that to the students.
Let me ask you this, Rose. Did the students not like the succulent, crispy chicken tender bites with the Polynesian sauce, or was it for the political views?
Absolutely,
of the Chick-fil-A owners?
Yeah, we're definitely a LGBT-friendly campus, so that was definitely a huge prompt. We have a good atmosphere of that, and the campus is very progressively open-minded, so this was to be expected, but there's nothing set in stone in our CRR that talks about these things, and I think that needs to be addressed when we have this progressive mindset.
First Amendment lawyer Greg Lukianoff, what do you think about the ambiguous rules that some colleges put forth that don't exactly hinder First Amendment or suppress First Amendment, but make it difficult to define or quantify?
Oh, but I think almost everything she listed, though, does hinder the First Amendment. And I think a lot of, particularly like 10 days advance notice, are things that have been overturned by courts time and time again. I mean, like, for example, and I think that universities are good at sort of presenting these things as just, you know, reasonable restrictions on speech when they just don't generally hold up on court for very good reasons. Like, there was a case that I talked about in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago at Christopher Newport University. You had a bunch of progressive students get together to protest Paul Ryan speaking at the at Christopher Newport University, and they were told on Sunday that he would be speaking, and but that he'd be speaking on Tuesday, and they were banned from having a protest of Paul Ryan because it required a 10-day advance notice for students to engage in their free speech rights. So a lot of these things that universities try to pass off as sort of reasonable restrictions on freedom of speech utterly eliminate the opportunity when they arise to be politically involved. And I think that one of the things I was trying to say in my New York Times piece was that, you know, we bemoan, and I think often wrongly, that we think students are, you know, apathetic when it comes to politics. But in case after case that we see every election year, they're made to leap over oftentimes unconstitutional hurdles just to be able to do basic things like protest a vice presidential candidate.
We asked our Twitter followers how much control should colleges have over students and faculty's right to free speech, and the replies we've gotten have been brief and to the point. For instance, Steve Fuller tweeted zero, the word zero, in terms of how much control colleges should have over students and faculty's right to free speech. Kevin sends in an email at centralstandard@kcur.org saying, as a 2009 high school graduate of Shawnee Mission West, I've had a first-hand experience. The school was sending my attendance and grades to my parents' name instead of me after I turned 18 years old, which is a federal offense. Shawnee Mission West did not seem to care until I contacted 3rd District Congressman. Also, Shawnee Mission West suspended several kids while I was there for saying Viking instead of Brave at the end of the national anthem during games. They banned it, and it still suspends students for saying this. I don't understand the Viking and Brave controversy, but it seems like an issue of words and an issue of speech that begins in high school, as you pointed out earlier in the hour there, Greg.
Yeah, and there was a case that came down about the. Do you guys remember the Bong Hits for Jesus case? This is a case up in Alaska where some high school students had a sign at a parade that said Bong Hits for Jesus was their group. It's a joke. I actually thought the joke was kind of funny when it happened, but unfortunately they decided to fight this one all the way up to the Supreme Court while never using the word joke in their description of what Bong Hits for Jesus meant. So you end up with this bizarre Justice Roberts opinion where he tries to figure out what Bong Hits for Jesus means. And he has in brackets, maybe it means Bong Hits for Jesus brackets are good or brackets do Bong Hits for Jesus. And it's like, no, this is why we don't actually try to investigate what a joke means. We end up looking like fools when we do it. But it's a larger sign of this general erosion of high school student rights that I think that somewhat bleed into the rights of college students as well.
And talk about that sort of suppression of irony. We're going to go to Quentin Savoir of Rockhurst College in a minute, but give us a primer on that sort of suppression and policing of irony and humor on college campuses as well.
Sure, yeah. I think one of the most dramatic examples, and it's one of these reasons why it's such a bad idea to police speech, particularly of younger people, because sometimes they're saying, you know, the exact opposite of what you think they're saying. They're actually being ironic or sarcastic. But probably one of the most spectacular examples was a student, African-American student, with a big sense of humor. He made a play called The Passion of the Musical, with the stated goal, very much like South Park, of making fun of identity politics, making fun of everybody, every religion on campus in the form of a comedy musical that was making fun of The Passion of the Christ. He wrote on everything, if you offend easy, do not come to this show. It was in the ads, it was written on the tickets, and they got up in front of the audience and explained beforehand. Meanwhile, the school had actually worked with angry students who were angry at some of the content of the play. And again, a comedy musical. And they bought the angry students tickets, had a little seminar about how you should stand up and yell, I'm offended, which was just all the more ironic because they were supposed to be offended. That was the point of the entire musical. And so 40 of them show up and they start disrupting the play and things get really out of hand to no real surprise. They start shouting death threats. They start throwing saying that they're going to hurt the people on the stage. And the campus police say that, listen, you're going to have to shut this down because we're not going to protect you. And it's this really and to make matters worse, the university president defended what the disruptor students had done, the ones who were shouting threats and actually got a musical shutdown, that they had a very responsible exercise of freedom of speech in doing that. And I it's like a facepalm. I don't understand how you could possibly misunderstand freedom of speech so much to think that you have a right to go to a play you don't like and shut it down with threats.
Let's bring in Quentin Savoir, a communications and political science major at Rockhurst here up the street here in Kansas City. Quentin, you were concerned about a conservative indoctrination before you attended Rockhurst, but you were pleasantly surprised. Tell us about that experience.
Yes, I was pleasantly surprised. Attending Rockhurst and being a political science major, I just knew that I would go in and I would leave with the right-wing ideology of the political spectrum. But I've been pleasantly surprised. We have two full-time political science faculty, and interwoven in the core of each class I've taken has been to be a critical thinker, to look at all sides of the spectrum. In fact, one of my professors this semester, he said, flat out, you know I'm a conservative, but Quentin, I'm relying on you to keep me honest. So he welcomes the debate. He welcomes the disagreement because at Rockhurst, when the students are arriving, a little bit different from UMKC, they're on campus, they are residents of the campus, and this is their first time away from mom and dad. So they're forming their opinions and ideologies about politics and social justice and other issues that would face typical college students. So when we are having an exchange in the classroom of a political nature, they're able to see both sides of the spectrum and then take all of the elements of the debate and decide what they feel is true and rich for them.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're talking with Quentin Savoir, a political science and communications major at Rockhurst. Rose Brooks, she's a senior majoring in journalism and creative writing at the UMKC campuses, and they are students at respectively public and private universities here in Kansas City. And it all forms around the conversation we're having today with First Amendment lawyer Greg Lukianoff, the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights. of Education or FIRE. He joins us from NPR Studios in New York and is author of the book Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship and the End of American Debate. Quentin, has the free speech sort of litmus test at Rockhurst ever been tested? Have any protests been suppressed? Has that freedom that you're experiencing ever been tested?
No.
Not while you're there?
Not while I've been there. And this is my... I started at Rutgers in fall of 2011. So since I've been there, there have been things that students have felt, you know, the campus could have done differently, the administration could have done differently, et cetera. But we have a very open campus. We have a student publication that, you know, runs regularly. We have student-run social media networks. We have a student government that frequently hosts town halls where they're encouraging the entire campus to come out. They purchase food for the evening, and we just talk about whatever issues we have on campus or things that can be done to improve and enhance our experience as students.
So it's a very quaint and cordial environment.
It would certainly seem that way. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that a lot of the students that are coming there don't quite know what they think yet. They have an idea, or they know what mom and dad have told them, but they're still forming what they feel is right and just.
A lot of students don't quite know what they think yet, and we'll turn to Rose, not saying that you don't quite know what you think yet, but we'll turn to you. You said in your general education classes as a freshman and sophomore, you did feel that some of your professors, conversely at UMKC, did you feel that they were encouraging you to think critically?
In my gen eds, I guess it was either me not engaging as much in those topics because they weren't my thing, but I just feel like it was more they were asking you to regurgitate information than analyze your information and kind of think things. Whereas here, when I'm taking my more major specific courses in journalism and creative writing, they're definitely implementing those thoughts and having those conversations.
Greg Lukianoff, you present the mosaic of a freshman coming into a university. Do you feel that those general education courses in the first 2 years and the sort of herd-like mentality and the weed-out-like mentality of the educational curriculum, do you feel that has anything to do with the lack of critical thinking as well? Does that factor in?
I'm generally supportive, and this is me taking my FIRE hat off. I generally am supportive of general education, partially because I believe in things like if you're studying science, I still think you need to know civics, for example.
You should.
I think that there is just some basic, and I think it comes down to any course can be taught in a way that prompts critical thinking, and any course can be taught in a way that detracts from it. And I've seen spectacular examples in my own life of some courses that should have been incredibly fascinating, should have been incredibly thought-provoking, being taught in a completely the only thing that mattered was the opinion of the professor, and that's not gonna help you develop critical thinking skills. I've had others where I had no idea what the politics of my professor was. I just knew that he liked to get a good debate going and get a good talk going. And the interesting thing about that is students tend to enjoy those kind of classes more as well.
Speaking of stoking the fires of the debate, you bring up a example of the president of Harvard, Lawrence Summers, the former U.S.
Sure.
Treasury Secretary, making a comment about the disparity in IQ or intelligence between men or women when it came to entering into the science, technology, and mathematics fields. And he was actually meant to provoke an argument and a debate on that fact. He was actually, in effect, saying, prove me wrong. But that ended up being a huge hubbub. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's one of these things where I really encourage people, because this case has become so iconic that people don't bother to actually read what he actually said. And it's this long speech about how he was invited specifically to this conference about the lack of representation in theoretical physics by women. And to offer some provocative theories on why. And he talked about preference, that women seem to be drawn to other sciences more than to like theoretical physics and some of the harder sciences, but they're starting to dominate things like biology and chemistry and other sciences. And he talked about discrimination as being one factor. And he also talked about some research that indicates that at the highest level of IQ, and we're talking about the 165 types, that there might be somewhat more men than women. And there is some research that indicates that's true. But he also said, I hope that's not true. I hope that the research will not bear that out. And that ultimately he thought that a lot of it had to do actually was more likely to do with preference, that people of different genders are not identical, and that sometimes they like to study different things. But even though he prepared it with so much language saying,
this is I'm invited here to be provocative. I'm here to like really blow your minds. I'm about to blow your minds, and I hope it's not true. And he mentioned this as one possibility. It's still what eventually led to him having to step down as president of Harvard.
John tweets in at KCURCST, the freedom of speech is not for those who agree, but defined for those who disagree. As a student, I disagree often. Thank you, John, for that very impressive tweet. Speaking of which, let's talk with our students, Rose and Quentin. Do you feel like the world you're coming into, Rose, do you feel like they're setting a good example as far as free speech and as far as discourse that's amiable and polite? What do you think of the world?
Wow,
indeed.
That question. I definitely feel that there's a good foundation in place. But I think there's discrepancy in between exercising your own free speech and calling someone out and telling them that they can't. Because you can say all you want, but then you tell someone else that, oh, I disagree with you, so you shouldn't be able to say that. You're being, you know, blindsided and simple-minded when you say things like that. So I think the foundation is there, but the general public and ideologies of certain people need to, they clash, and they shouldn't.
What do you think needs to be changed about the world you're coming into? She sighs.
I know. I guess I think people just need to sit down and assess that if they want to have their opinion heard, they have to listen to other people's. Like, there's plenty of things on my campus that I disagree with, but I, as a journalist and as someone, I have to kind of be unbiased. And I think people need to sit down and assess how they can be unbiased before they speak against someone else speaking out.
Quentin, how do you feel about the world you're graduating into? Do you feel like there's a sensible debate in the political and cultural sphere? Is that lacking?
Man. Yes, it is. It's most certainly
right?
lacking.
Absolutely.
And based on just my learnings at Rockhurst, it has made me a far more aware individual. So when I hear about things about students being censored or not being encouraged to think, I think it's devastating for democracy. And then we live in a culture where everything is so digital, everything's so fast-paced. People form opinions based on 12 words and a headline, and they think they're an expert on that subject matter, as opposed to sitting and engaging in intelligent debate or just sitting and researching something so that they can be well in-depth and informed to know something. I think it's very crippling, and it's very sad.
Greg Lukianoff, Quentin Savoir brings up a very good point. When you have this unscholarly certainty in our cultural ethos and in our national conversation, and you have it coming at you so quickly, and you have your reaction being able to be disseminated so quickly, how do you reverse that?
I think that it requires some changing the culture. And I do think that in some ways Twitter has been a positive has a positive impact, believe it or not, I think on the way we at least read the discourse because of the 140 character limit. And I think when that's in place, you have to ask yourself, what does this person really mean by what they actually just tweeted? And I think that that's a question that particularly we've gotten so sort of polarized and we tend to like live in our own echo chambers that we've forgotten that great habit in so many cases of being, what did this person intend to say? What was their intention by what they said? And I think that if we were to just even get that habit back into political discourse, not immediately demonizing the people who we disagree with and actually sitting down to have a conversation about stuff to try to figure out where people are coming from, I think we'd be living in a much less tedious society than we currently live in.
Greg Lukianoff, you do mention a notable exception at the University of Alaska from 2001 where President Mark Hamilton said free speech should never be qualified. He has since retired, but talk about what he said during that crucial announcement, that crucial statement.
This was a case back in 2001. An English professor had written a poem called "Indian Girls." It's a beautiful poem. It's very impressionistic. It's hard to tell exactly what's going on, but it seems to talk about sexual abuse among an Eskimo tribe or Inuit tribe in Alaska. You know, some of which there have been reports about that. But at the same time, again, very impressionistic, very, you know, you can't really tell exactly what's going on. But partially because of this sort of, you know, outrage machine, people were calling for her to be fired by implying that Inuits could actually sexually abuse their children. Now, sexual abuse, of course, being a problem in virtually every society in the world, unfortunately. But they were still calling for her to be kicked out for her poem. And President Hamilton wrote a ringing endorsement of why we cannot launch an investigation into this, because this is one thing that universities, they try to sort of split the baby by saying, oh, yeah.
We're looking into it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Your speech may be protected, but we're still going to have a hearing and a trial and all that kind of stuff just to establish that. But he understood that if speech is protected, that ends it. That ends the investigation. There was nothing to investigate, as President Hamilton wrote. And I think that is the right attitude, because as soon as you actually create a situation where, yeah, we're not going to find you guilty, but you can still be hauled into disciplinary hearings for your poem, who's going to bother writing anything interesting?
And you said in the very next line, after you cited Mark Hamilton's treatise on free speech, you said if more university presidents had this type of idea, you'd be out of a job or doing something else.
I could totally retire. I could write comic books like I've always wanted to.
You may be able to write a comic book with some of these ridiculous First Amendment suppression ideas. What's it going to take for colleges and universities to be able to embrace free expression on a go-forward basis there, Greg?
You know, FIRE talks a lot about changing the culture on campus, and I think that and how exactly you do that, I don't entirely know. When you have such large bureaucracies, when you have such sort of so many people with not a lot of transparency and a lot of power over students, abuse is, you know, naturally going to happen. So I think in some ways just general higher education reform to try to figure out how to do it in a leaner, cheaper way will help a lot. I think that will be part of it. But I think that, you know, when I talk about supporting Gen Op classes, one thing that I think would be great is debate and discussion classes, where people learn to take the other side in arguments, which is something that the book shows research that students are very bad at doing that, at least according to different studies. If you were to have a little bit more of that, I think we could actually start to get why engaging people you disagree with can make you so much smarter.
Carla writes in from Lawrence. Yesterday, the University of Kansas campus, there were several individuals preaching to students passing by at a central gathering place on the KU campus. One woman in particular was being quite lewd, inflammatory, and downright rude. The student response, some are heckling her, at least one was agreeing with her, and some were using her ability to draw a crowd to collect money for a charity. Four students eventually formed a makeshift band and played about 20 feet away to drown her out, while one student drew attention away from her hateful rant by breaking into a dance. Best part was that despite the fact that she had been on campus for over 3 hours and the administration never interfered, they did not try to take away from everyone's signs, quiet the musicians, kick the preaching woman off campus, or ask anyone for permits to demonstrate. And I think that's a good example of how the First Amendment can work for everybody.
Absolutely.
We've been talking with First Amendment lawyer Greg Lukianoff, the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. He joins us from NPR Studios in New York. He's the author of a book called Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate. Thank you very much, Greg, for joining us.
Thank you.
We also had a political science and communications major, Quentin Savoir, and Rose Books, a senior majoring in journalism and creative writing at UMKC. They go to Rockhurst and UMKC, respectively. Rose, Quentin, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And tune in tomorrow as the movie critics chime in on the latest Silver Screen Fair. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, executive produced by Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Muter runs our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. What you're hearing right now, or we're hearing, is by the Wilnots. Up to Date is next. I'm Javelani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.